Welcome back, everybody. Today's Local Hour is a special Wednesday edition of the David Samson Show. I'm your host, Mike Ryan. And David, we have a World Series game to react to, and Clayton Kershaw has done it. He has finally put together a memorable World Series performance. The book on him is that he chokes in the postseason. Your reaction to Clayton Kershaw last night?
You know that in the last five starts I think he's made in the postseason, his ERA is about 3.5. I think that people have pretty much been overreacting. When you have, let's say, four World Series starts, and one of them is against the Astros in 17, where you get your ass completely kicked, all of a sudden your ERA is going to be ballooned. In the regular season, if a starter has a bad game, he's got 25 other starts to get his ERA back. As a matter of fact, every starter has a bad game or two where they just get shelled, whether they're stealing signs or not. So I think that when he gives up runs, when he comes in out of the bullpen and gives up a run or two in a postseason game, or when he doesn't have a Clayton Kershaw-like start, to me it's the equivalent of Dwayne Wade on the Heat shooting in two games, you know, 4 for 17. He does that. People do that. So I never really subscribed to the notion that Clayton Kershaw was not a good postseason pitcher, because it's one of those media things that everyone talks about because it's good content, and then it takes on a life of its own. Then everyone asks him about it. Then it gets into his head. Then it gets self-perpetuated and on and on and on. And last night, he just said, you know what? Screw this. I'm taking the ball. He had every pitch working for him, and the Rays just couldn't touch him. Can't touch this. No.
Easy. We got
that. Can't touch this.
We got royalty worries there. So Clayton Kershaw famously signed a big extension to his deal. Was he actually worth it? I know you famously, outside of Giancarlo Stanton, never wanted to hand out big money deals. Was Clayton Kershaw actually worth the money?
Well, what he got an extension, and he got, let's say, $30 million a year for a couple of years, and he is not worth that amount. And that was an extension given because he's no longer, he's not really a true number one anymore at all. He's a great number two who sometimes pitches like a 2.5 or a 3. But the fact is that the Dodgers said to themselves, he's a Hall of Fame Dodger. He is maybe, is it possible that he'd be one of the top four Dodgers of all time? We'd really have to go through and think about that. But until he wins a ring, I don't know that he can be considered that. But that said, the ownership just said, you know what? We want him to retire a Dodger, so we're going to give him a couple years, like a pillow deal. It actually reminded me of the Kobe Bryant contract that it's hard to talk about now because of the tragic loss of him. But when the Dodgers, I don't know if people recall this, he was given a huge contract toward the end of his career for a swan song, and it actually impacted the Dodgers, the Lakers greatly.
I'm looking it up right now. I think you can say with certainty that he is a top four Dodger. Sandy Koufax, obviously. There's this guy, Maury Wills, that I looked up when
you
I Googled.
You know Maury Wills?
I did not, but he is, by consensus, one of the top Dodgers. I guess you have to lump in, because of what he meant for the game, and a pretty decent player, Jackie Robinson. And Clayton Kershaw, I think, is slotted right there.
It's so, by the way, Maury Wills came to Jupiter, Florida, and was a special instructor during spring training when I was with the Expos. And he was trying to teach our guys base running, and one of the great all-time players and one of the great all-time nice guys. But we had young players like a Vladimir Guerrero. He never heard of Maury Wills. So I thought that Maury Wills would have this gravitas coming into spring training, and the players thought that he was some sort of interloper. It was very bizarre, actually. That was my first experience, Maury Wills, in the realization that I was old, even though I was in my 30s when I started, and that these young players, especially some who come from the Dominican, just have no idea of the history of baseball.
Let's talk about the game of baseball. It was obviously, it felt like it was on unstable ground, the future of the game. The game had changed to a diluted version that wasn't as fun for people like me, and other things happen, life happened, and the game doesn't necessarily age well for the shorter attention span that we've got now in 2020. However, there are very encouraging stories when you look at the ratings. TV ratings are up on the RSNs, And comparatively to the NBA Finals, there are some really good stories to tell with how baseball is performing head-to-head with Sunday Night Football. Granted, Game 6, even though it was a title-clinching game of the NBA Finals, it was a blowout. What do we make of what's going on with the TV ratings here in Major League Baseball? Because it seems as though we're on an uptick right now of interest in the game.
I'm glad you asked that, because it's bothersome to me as a former executive, the importance of ratings that people in the media and general fans have, and they read the articles. NFL ratings are down 48%, and MLB ratings down 12%. Only 5.8 million people watched the NBA Finals game, where 12.7 million people watched the NFL football game that same night. So the way it works is, from a money standpoint, when you're an executive in baseball, the only thing that ratings matters for is PR. So you don't get those crazy, ridiculous articles. It matters not in your wallet. The national TV partners are giving money to baseball hand over fist because they crave, need, and require live programming. They're not looking at ratings. When I was negotiating with the regional sports network to a TV deal for the Marlins, the reason why the TV deal was so bad, because I negotiated it in 2005 and we took upfront money to help sign Carlos Delgado and Al Leiter, et cetera. So the annual deal going forward wasn't as much as it would have been because we took money up front. But they never, when negotiating, said, you know what, your ratings are a 1.4. or you don't have enough people in Miami watching, or you guys don't win 80 games, or you guys are hated because you trade away players. None of that. They look at the DMA size. They look at the number of subscribers in the area who literally are potential buyers of Fox Sports Florida. And if you have 6 million subscribers in Fort Lauderdale, Miami, et cetera, you slot in with other teams around baseball around their subscriber numbers, not around ratings. And on the national side, it's the same thing. So we never focused on ratings around the sport except for the press releases.
You would be a perfect person to ask this. I always wondered how, as a South Floridian, I was able to watch the Tampa Bay Rays on Sun Sports, but I'm not able to watch the Orlando Magic on Sun Sports. The Orlando Magic's games are blacked out, but I get to see an out-of-market baseball team in the Tampa Bay Rays. How did that work?
So when teams start, every team in baseball, it's the coolest map I ever saw inside the commissioner's office, and they hide it as though it is the Declaration of Independence trying to be found by John Gates. And it is John Gates, I think, was the character's name in National Treasure. Or whatever, Nicolas Cage. So it's a map that has the territories of every Major League Baseball team, the television territories, and they're not as obvious as you would think. So the Marlins, as an example, have South Florida, which is the three counties, but then they also have a scattering of counties in the north and even a scattering of counties in states above, like in Kentucky. There's like one or two areas where the Marlins have their territory. And then Tampa has Western Florida and then a few other scattered territories. But when they came in, part of the deal was, when it came to expansion, is that they would not have the exclusive right. So the Marlins would be able to show Tampa Bay games in the rest of Florida in those counties. So when you look at, let's say, New York and Boston and where their sort of territories are, it is simply fascinating. There's gerrymandering that goes on when you are trying to figure out where your territory is going to be. And it's a huge problem for fans because there are fans who live in Iowa, for example, and there are eight teams blacked out in Iowa. So they literally can't watch practically anybody, but it's all done because regional sports networks want exclusive areas. They're okay with certain non-exclusive areas because what they're doing is they're counting subs. That is the whole game.
So you're telling me during your time as Marlins team president, you had a subscription base in Kentucky?
but it's not. But there's, by the way, I'm telling you that I couldn't add or subtract from the territory. Those territories are locked. If you want to change your TV territory in baseball, you have a better chance of moving mountains. Literally, you can't do it. It's all written. It's all done. And the answer is yes. When you count the number of subscribers, when you're doing deals, you're counting every last one of them. What I never realized until I moved to Florida in 02 is that the TV market is phenomenal. It's much bigger than it was in Montreal, as an example. But the actual people who can buy season tickets and be suite holders, they all disappear during the summer. But they count as the demographic and as the TV size because they've got residency and cable sort of subscriptions in Florida, but then they go away to the Northeast during the summer months. Didn't know that when I moved in, never was told that by anyone, but figured it out within a couple of moments the first summer.
It's just so wild to me that someone is flipping through their channels in Kentucky and they come across their RSN and there's a Marlins game. There's game three of a three-game set against the St. Louis Cardinals, and we'll be right back at you with Marlins coverage next weekend. It's just
I'm gonna
wild.
Try to get that map. I probably have that map in a file somewhere, and because it's just such a funny map to see where different teams have different pockets throughout the country.
When I went to Fort Wayne, a great minor league town, great ballpark, an affiliate of the San Diego Padres, and I was wondering, wouldn't it be cool if they got Padres games there on their RSN, because they don't actually have a baseball team in Indiana. I imagine they're mostly Cubs fans out there or Cleveland Indian fans. But wouldn't it be cool to be able, because there's a clear path, like Tatis went through Fort Wayne. Ryan Weathers went through Fort Wayne. Wouldn't it be cool to be able to see the major league team, and that way you really get to grow the fan base in that market? Or is it just so the very nature of minor league baseball and switching affiliates, which I don't like, by the way, it's not, the juice is not worth the squeeze.
That's the issue. So affiliates change. You can't keep redrawing TV markets according to affiliates because they change so often. Now, with the way that minor league baseball is going and the contraction that's going to happen and the changes that are going to take place, the purpose of that is to have much more continuity for AAA and AA affiliates of teams. So when they have an affiliation, it stays that way, not for 2 or 4 years, which are the normal lengths of contracts, but for longer, you know, 10, 15, 20 years. That would make your story and your possible desire possibly compelling. But the reason why it won't happen is that Fort Wayne is in the district of a different team, not the Padres.
I didn't really understand why Fort Wayne was so far from San Diego and was a Padres affiliate. You guys encountered this when your double A affiliate was in Albuquerque, the Isotopes.
That's AAA.
That was your AAA, and yes. It just didn't make sense.
Nightmare.
Back in the day, they would be a little bit more regional, right? The affiliate, because it would be a quick bus ride. Now, affiliates are thousands of miles away, it feels.
Have I ever told you the story, I don't know if I have, of the musical chairs game that goes on between major league teams and minor league teams when there's an affiliate matchup party, basically, where everyone knows which teams are expiring with which affiliates. And you try to seduce the owner of these minor league teams. It's insane the lengths that you go to because you so badly want your AAA and AA affiliate near to your major league team. Because after a doubleheader or after an extra inning game or an acute injury where you have to get a player, it's not like you have a week till the next game. You have to get a player immediately to the big league club. And if we're playing in Miami and we need to get a guy from Albuquerque, it's not like there's a private plane going back and forth. They fly commercially, and it's always a connection. It's a total pain in the neck. We had players flying on overnight flights and getting right to the ballpark and then playing. You just don't want it. And the minor league owners know this. So part of the winter meetings, which are probably going to be canceled this year, but a rite of passage, every team does a minor league affiliate party. So you put on a big party for all these minor league employees, and the minor league owners all come, and you bring all of your celebrity people associated with your organization to try to impress them. So you bring all the special assistants, you get the manager, you get the owner has to go, the president, the GM, everyone goes, and you walk around the room and you feed them, you serve them drinks, you basically kiss their ass. trying to keep them. It is so absurd.
Who's the Marlins contingent? Are you bringing Andre Dawson and Tony Perez?
Of course, every time. And you have them stand there and they mingle and they look and they have the sense of gravitas, and the minor league employees and owners and GMs are awestruck, like their jaws are open because they get to hang out with these people. So it's always, hey, who you bringing? Oh God, we need to keep Albuquerque. So, you know, we're actually going to fly in a little ringer here to see if we can do something, and we're giving them a gift. And then we're going to go to Albuquerque and play an exhibition game. That whenever you see, before a season starts, exhibition games between the big league team and their minor league team on the site of their minor league team, which major league players hate to do because they have to, it's an extra travel trip.
Yeah.
It's because that's something that we say, all right, we'll fly there and do a game if you become our affiliate. And so all these teams match up. It reminds me of a middle school dance. And every once in a while, there's a team sitting there, a total loser in the corner, can't get anyone to go dancing, and they end up in Vegas.
Really? You would have thought
that. You don't want your minor league affiliate in Vegas.
Why? Is that just off-field concerns? The Dodgers had the Las Vegas, was it 51s, I think?
51s. The facility is terrible. In the old days, the facility was terrible, and you had the Vegas issue. Now, there were owners who would say, no, that's great because we're going to win more games there because road teams come into Vegas and they go crazy and they're tired. Give me a break. No, you don't want to be in Vegas.
So Albuquerque,
now, you want to be in Vegas as a major league team, but yeah, not a minor league
so
team.
Albuquerque was near the top of your list because it's sort of bizarro Las Vegas. You're not going to get in trouble in Albuquerque.
No, we didn't. No, we didn't want to be in Albuquerque. It was always too far away.
Yeah.
No, we never chose.
So how'd you get stuck with Albuquerque? You guys just it's like that, because
it's the game
because
of musical chairs,
right? Because the minor league owners, the same way that you're looking at minor league teams, the minor league owners are looking around like, well, there's Andre Dawson and Tony Perez there, but look at the Red Sox luminaries. Let me go over here. I want to be associated with the Red Sox. And even though you were 2-time World Series champions, you're still the Marlins, so you're probably not the belle of the ball.
And the reason why affiliates never liked being with the Marlins is not just because of the winter meeting party. It's that we never cared under our watch, never cared about the minor league teams in terms of what their record was. And minor league owners want their team to win because that's how they get more gate and that's how they make their money. That's the only way minor league teams make money is having a game, which is why the pandemic has been such a nightmare for minor league baseball. And in addition to the fact there was no minor league baseball, but they want players who are not going to be there for a day and a half and then called up prematurely by the major league team because the major league team needs money, right? So they actually like teams, big market teams, who are always signing free agents, who are always going to have high paid guys in the minor leagues, big names. They're a little older, but they're there as sort of, you know, backup for the big league team. We didn't use our minor league teams that way. We kept our young players there and then called them up as quickly as we could.
Who is the crown jewel of minor league baseball?
The person?
No, the organization. The one that everybody wants to be affiliated with. Top notch. Great pathway to the majors. When you enter the minor league baseball courting party, who does everybody have eyes on?
Well, it depends on the location, right? There are West Coast teams who are very fine to be with Albuquerque. It really is based on location. That's the whole deal. It's
right.
Not about the owner. It's not about anything other than that.
So the Durham Bulls walk in there and no one gives a shit about like their actual marketing capacity because of Bull
not
Durham.
One shit. Literally zero. Literally zero.
They didn't buy anything with you when the Durham Bulls walk in there, being a cinephile like you are. You're not. It'd be kind of cool to be associated with Durham.
Listen, I wanted Vegas because then when I go see minor league teams, I could go to Vegas, right? I don't want to go to certain other cities, right? It's nice when we had Jacksonville, and I think the Marlins still do. I don't know because that's a quick drive and you can get there easily. We had Carolina for a while. You look at proximity to airports and you look at the flight schedule of the airports and where those airports fly to and how many connections. It's a very practical business-like way of evaluating. But no, there's no Crash Davises and there's none of that. Now, some minor league teams send you some stuff once you're an affiliate. They'll give you hats and stuff like that. But no, it never mattered to me.
I want to ask you now about shows that you're watching, because I put myself out there and I sacrificed. I wasn't ready to go ahead and give you the full endorsement, but I did after talking it out with you after a few episodes in. The Vow. Now, The Vow is this docuseries on the Nexium cult out of upstate New York. And I am now on the second to last episode of the season, which is infuriating because there's a season two. Because part of my problem here is the editing and the pacing of this show and the nuance and the context that they want to apply to everything. When I'm just give me the sensationalism at this point, the show ends up being more self-righteous than the actual cult, I feel. So I would like to retract that, but I don't think by the rules. I just don't think I'm batting 1,000 anymore. Tell me you didn't actually take my advice and start this show.
Can I disclose our communications on this show?
Go for it.
Okay. You sent me a text on Friday at 2023. I rescind my recommendation. So I didn't watch it.
All right.
I thought that you rescinded your recommendation.
Good, good. Well, then this is a conversation for the on-air people, because I have a reputation to uphold. Do not watch The Vow. Just don't do it. Gigantic waste of time.
It wasn't even a question. The minute you said I rescind my recommendation, and I'll show you what else I have on my phone because it's so ridiculously funny to me. I guess we're audio only. But I have a list of shows that people have told me to watch, and The Vow was on it, and then I just hit delete, delete, delete. Ross, it's not even on it.
Don't waste your time. I want to bring another one of our text conversations on the air. You think the greatest Michael Mann movie is Heat. And a lot of people go there. That's the easy call. Some might even say Ali because of Will Smith's brilliant performance in that film. And you're a big Muhammad Ali fan, so I'd like to talk to you about that too. But I have a hot take that it's actually Michael Mann's early 2000s film, Collateral, starring Tom Cruise and Jamie Foxx. I watched it again this weekend after listening to a podcast about the filming of Collateral. This movie holds up really well. The way that it's shot, it was sort of at the start of digital film, so it looks kind of bizarre when you hold it to other films. And now, because now you shoot on digital and you really can't tell the difference. But back then, it had a very distinct look to it. The lighting was perfect. The performances were pitch perfect. I love this film, Collateral, and I'm willing to say it's Michael Mann's best film because it's aged more gracefully than movies like Heat.
First of all, I disagree. Heat has aged gracefully, and watching De Niro and Pacino, I enjoy that better than The Irishman. I enjoy that better than so many movies that Pacino and De Niro have made. But I do have a question. Do you guys go after Tom Cruise on the show the way you go after Nick Cage?
I love Tom Cruise. I think we hold him in high regard. Nicolas Cage is just another level because Nicolas Cage is just so outwardly bizarre, where Tom Cruise is more privately bizarre, I guess, than Nicolas Cage.
I'm not so sure anything about him is private, Mikey. He's, you know, this from Scientology, etc. My point is Tom Cruise has made a score of great movies. Collateral is a great movie, but people sort of overlook it the way they overlook Vanilla Sky, which is a phenomenal movie. Tom Cruise makes good movies. I loved Collateral, but I want to just give you my pitch for Heat. The tension of that movie, the length of the movie, the supporting performances by Amy Brenneman and by Val Kilmer, and the reality that De Niro and Pacino did not share a scene until toward the end of this, what in those days was a very long movie. It bubbled up this tension that I thought was captured so amazingly because of the stars who played the parts. I didn't feel the tension between the roles that De Niro and Pacino were playing. The tension that Mann did was using the actors as the people they are and the competition they have in the movie. And that to me is what made it like mind blowing. When I just remember I was enraptured by that movie.
I remember the marketing, and it was a massive deal to have Al Pacino and Robert De Niro finally share scenes. And there was all this buildup and anticipation for the film throughout the trailer. Oh my God, Pacino and De Niro are in the same movie, and within the movie, you're just so ready to see them in the same scene. And Michael Mann teases and teases and teases. I remember when it went to Blockbuster, and it was the old dual VHS. That tells you how it's probably too long now. If you watch it back, the movie does kind of drag in parts, but I remember it being a massive deal that Pacino and De Niro were finally going to share a scene in the movie. And then I start watching, I'm like, when the hell are they going to share this scene? So Michael Mann does a brilliant job there. And yes, because they're older now and they've done other projects together, it's become a little bit diluted. You have to sort of go into Heat knowing, man, it was such a big deal to have De Niro and Pacino share screen time.
So when I think about Heat, I think about interleague play in baseball. Back in the day when the World Series would come, it was against two teams that don't play each other. You had an American League team and a National League team. And that's what De Niro and Pacino are. They were American League and National League. You don't see them together. You think they could be the same person because they're never in the same room together. They're never in a scene together. Then all of a sudden when it happens, it becomes this must-see moment in baseball. But then it becomes watered down. Right? That's what interleague Super. Now is. There's no more interleague baseball. No one cares anymore because it's every year, it's every series. That's something that once baseball expands, I hope they get rid of interleague when they've got an equal number of teams, 16 and 16 instead of 15 and 15, because now you have to have interleague. And that's how I viewed Pacino and De Niro.
I'm with you. I don't like interleague play because I remember when interleague play started, it was exciting. But even then, I was sort of old school. I really like being able to watch teams face off for the very first time in the World Series. And it was a real thing, which league has bragging rights. It was cool. And now there's just so many interleague games. You're playing the Yankees with far more regularity. Even when it first started, like you would go like 5 years without playing the New York Yankees. And it still meant a little something. Now, teams are starting the season with interleague play, and it just totally dilutes the experience for me. But you mentioned something interesting there, the certainty that Major League Baseball is going to expand. I haven't heard people speak in certain terms like that. Obviously, you enter this discussion with knowledge. What are the most likely destinations, and are they both coming into the league at the same time, and how soon do you foresee this happening?
So they're going to go from 30 to 32 teams. And that's something that's been planned for years. And there were meetings that I would sit in on. And it was just clear as day pre-pandemic that we're going to 32. You have to take care of the Tampa Stadium situation and the Oakland Stadium situation. And you can't name expansion cities until those cities step up and fund stadiums for Tampa and for Oakland. And the reason is that you cannot take the leverage away by putting teams, let's say, in Nashville or Charlotte or Montreal or Vegas or in Mexico City. You can't do that because in Tampa and Oakland, they're using the possibility of relocation to those expansion markets as a way to get public financing. But once Tampa and Oakland are taken care of, either with a new stadium or there's a relocation figured out, then you'll have a number of cities that will be vying for expansion. Two problems have happened since the pandemic started, and it is a push and pull. MLB needs to expand more than ever now because the owners want money. They need money. They've lost revenue, and expansion fees will be huge, absolutely huge because of franchise valuations, and it's a meaningful infusion of capital into each of the other 30 teams because every team gets 1/30th of expansion money. The problem is that the cities that were hoping to be expansion candidates, part of their pitch and their package is public financing for ballparks and support for season tickets, making sure there's corporate support. Now, because of the pandemic, the tax base in all of these expansion cities has been so devastated by the lack of food and beverage tax, by the lack of tourist tax, by the lack of all of the other normal revenues that cities have, that I'm not sure cities are going to be stepping up to do any public financing anytime soon. So that's the push and pull going on right now.
Except for maybe Las Vegas, which seems open for business, has additional taxes that other cities can't necessarily tap into with gambling. Is it safe to say that Las Vegas is probably one of these cities that Major League Baseball expands to?
Well, they are. And we tried to move to Vegas and we had a hard time getting any sort of public financing, even when it was popular to get public financing back in, you know, 04, 05, 06, 07, 08. And the problem with Vegas is you wanted the casinos. There were no sports teams back then. And the casinos were concerned that there would be any sort of distraction for its players. You want people in the casinos. That's where the money's made, not going to baseball games. Now that there is football, you could say, well, I guess they're okay with sports because hockey worked out so well and it's not killing anyone having 41 home games. The Golden Knights were selling out. The casinos bought all the luxury suites. Everything that we envisioned about Vegas happened with the Golden Knights, and they were good early. Remember, they made the Stanley Cup run. Well, it may have been their first year.
Yeah, now they made it to the Stanley Cup Finals, very first year.
It's sort of it's leveled off a bit. Sort of the excitement has worn off a little bit.
They made it to the Western Conference Finals this year.
They've been great. They've been great. But it used to be the first year in Vegas, when you'd go there during the Stanley Cup, it was just all about hockey. Now that the NFL is there, the NFL has completely overtaken it. And that's only 8 games a year, in theory, once fans are allowed. I think Vegas is concerned about having 81 games. Baseball is concerned about, again, during the summer, it is not as it's very difficult. You have to have a roof in Vegas, so that you have to build a certain type of ballpark that's costly. And remember, Vegas shut down for several months and the casinos got absolutely hammered. The county, the city got Clark County and the city got hammered because they lost so much revenue. I'm not really sure the timing anymore, and neither is baseball. And that's a problem because getting to 32 teams is critical for scheduling, and it's going to come with tremendous realignment. I think you will see potentially the end. We talked about getting rid of the American League and the National League and just making it one sort of
one game. Table. Yeah, one table. I could dig that. I just don't like it. It doesn't make sense to me to have divisions and American leagues and National leagues if you're just going to have interleague play. Just make everybody in the same league and just make sure your playoffs are the best teams. I think the leagues were sort of born and divisions were sort of born out of travel. And it harkens back to a day that travel was a lot more difficult than it is now. So get rid of it entirely.
You mean it was commercial? That's how they used to travel. You used to have teams walking through airports, going through security. Many of us who are older who used to travel for business, you'd be walking through an airport and you'd just see a team. And it's not a high school team. It's that, wow, that's a professional basketball team. Easy to spot, right? Very tall. Or that's it. It wasn't until, you know, 15, 20 years ago that everyone started flying commercially. It's privately, of course, I mean.
So you said you guys wanted to move to Las Vegas. Obviously, San Antonio was also in the mix, the famous cowboy hat that you had. How serious was the courting of Las Vegas? This was something you guys legitimately wanted to do over staying in Miami?
That you put in the word legitimately, right? I never wanted to move out of Miami at all.
Okay, so it was just, I'm just trying to figure out if it was just specifically a leverage play the way that San Antonio was, because no one wants to go to San Antonio. You can make the argument of wanting to be in Vegas. Or was this something that you guys had your heart set on? Like, oh no, we want to be the first major sports team in Las Vegas.
Well, A, that would have been terrific. We had a great stadium plan for Vegas, but again, we didn't look down on Portland. We didn't look down on San Antonio. We were hoping that Miami would step up and that we could stay in Miami because I love the city of Miami and wanted to spend my life there. And I felt as though it was best for the value of the team to get a ballpark somewhere in Miami. I thought it made more sense. But Vegas was very serious. So, you know, meeting with Oscar Goldman, the mayor at the time, and now it's, I think his wife is the mayor, believe it or not, which is quite interesting that it's been in the family for so long.
Oh, I've seen that kooky lady. Serious. I've seen that kooky lady on evening news and cable news. She was all here to be guinea pigs at the start of this.
That was her famous line. Yeah. Come on, open up, right? You can't have Vegas without casinos and without nightclubs, and without concerts. And it's been a nightmare for them. But they, back then, they wanted to be a professional sports city. The irony is that Miami spent so much time worrying about building facilities and public financing and being uncooperative. And there were other cities who just wanted to step up because they wanted to be known as a major league city. And I found that interesting. Look at Charlotte in basketball. They were an NBA city. They lost their team and all they did was try to get one back. And they did. Cities, we find Montreal lost a team. Now they're trying like hell to get baseball back. Cities, when they lose professional sports teams, they feel it in their chamber of commerce. They feel it in sort of the mood of their citizens. people judge cities according to how many sports teams they have. It's very bizarre.
Yeah, when Modell decided to go to Baltimore and take the Browns with him, even though it was a bit of a different situation, there was haggling over details, but I thought he was going to get cooperation from Cleveland, but he had already had his mind set on, no, I want to go to Baltimore. At that point, he fell in love with the concept of just moving the Browns to Baltimore and holding his grudge that the NFL basically said immediately, Cleveland's getting back into the league.
That was a bizarre thing, and it was almost immediately. And I remember that because they felt badly. The NBA did the same thing when Seattle moved to Oklahoma City. I got the feeling that they wanted to be back in Seattle quickly, but now it's been, I don't know how long it's been, maybe a decade they've been in Oklahoma City, and now Seattle's getting a hockey team before they're getting a basketball team.
You mentioned Mexico City. I always thought that the NBA was well-positioned to expand to Europe, given that travel is a little bit easier now. You're traveling private. Flights from New York to London are as long as flights from the East Coast to the West Coast. So you can basically hit up a 3-game road trip and fly back, and it's more conducive to a sport like basketball. How serious is the argument for international expansion within Major League Baseball?
Well, it's a huge moneymaker, but we've had a hard time because the union players actually don't like playing internationally, especially in Europe or Asia, because they really do believe it impacts their body. They don't like the time change. They have a hard time when they come back readjusting. And in baseball, I always thought it would work better because you'd have an opportunity to stay there and go on a 2-week road trip and make it so you're playing two teams and you could play an entire season series against a team each time. That'd be a disadvantage because you don't want to hit a team when they're hot. We always used to hate that. I can't believe we have to play the Mets 6 times in the next 9 days. And right now all their guys are back from injuries. But conversely, sometimes you love to play a team when they're missing a few guys for a few weeks. So it's hard to time it, but the players have not been all in, and the money for international baseball has not been as great. Like the London series was nice between the Yankees and the Red Sox. I think it's now 2 years ago, but nothing like the NBA or the NFL. I think the NFL will be the first to go international. I always thought the Jaguars were going to start splitting time and move to London. It made sense to me. And I think that the NFL will have a full-time team in London before any other sport.
It's got to be the Jaguars. Why else are we sending the Jaguars to London every year, building a fan base, which is actually working? I think the merchandise numbers actually support that. They're actually growing a fan base over there. The Khan family owns Fulham FC, which is in West London. It seems like it makes all the sense in the world. It feels like the NFL is telegraphing this move, but the Khan family has also made a ton of investment in the surrounding area in Jacksonville. So they can actually throw up their arms and say, hey, man, it just doesn't work here because they've given the right investment. Are these just write-offs to make that argument in the public eye when they've had their heart set on London the whole time?
Well, real estate is not a write-off, right? You get tremendous tax benefits when you're a real estate developer, but it has nothing to do with him owning the Jaguars or trying to be a great community guy. That's like saying that Jorge Mas wants to develop Mel Reese because he's so interested in soccer in Miami.
That's the pitch. We need to congregate a cultural center, Freedom Park.
Yeah, how's that going?
It's hit a snag. We'll see how the elections go. Let's see how the elections go. Unless you have more on the Khan family and the international thing, because one of the things.
No, I think of course he's planning to. He would much rather be the first team in London. There's huge money if you are going to be a full time team in London, but it requires union approval and it requires some gerrymandering of schedules and TV markets and time of games. So there's a lot to it.
I learned in a sports management class that I think in Major League Baseball, so players get, they always break it down per game. Mike Trout makes this per game. But with all the travel, you actually get tax whenever you go to a city, right? And you play in those cities per game, your paycheck gets taken out the taxes of the respective city that you're in. So I imagine there are teams like the Marlins that are playing so many Northeast teams with more punitive tax measures. And you're like, ah, damn, I'm getting more taken out of my check this go around than I would if I played a team in Texas.
So practically that's not how it works because first of all, people in Florida are so happy because they get half their season in Florida. So you get 81 of 162 in a team with no tax. Plus you get three road games in Florida because you're playing Tampa in the rivalry. So that's 84 games in the state of Florida. We actually don't withhold according to the states. That's up to the players to do. We'll do a withholding. They'll fill out a form like we all do when we work. Some players don't want any taxes withheld except what is the absolute minimum required by law. And then they've got to file taxes. But players and executives have to file tax returns in all of the states where they go with the team. So I would fill out tax returns in all these different states because I was working in those states.
Man, that's annoying.
It is beyond comprehension. It
right,
really
you,
is.
You learn something every day. All right, we're closing this episode out. Let's get to your review of the week, David.
I don't know how this happened, and I'm despondent about it, but every day I go and I watch a movie and I look to see what's new, what can I watch? And I came across a movie called Guest House with Pauly Shore and Amy Teengarden, maybe? Someone from Friday Night Lights.
I've never heard of this film.
Pauly Shore plays as a 55-year-old the exact same character he used to play when he was a 20-year-old.
Well, he's not really known for his range, David.
Range. It's he starts and finishes on the green, right? That's it. He plays miniature golf. That's his range in golf. And not that I'm a golfer. It's 84 minutes where all I did was watch, saying to myself, holy crap, Pauly Shore must have needed a paycheck. Because there is no explanation how this movie was greenlit. There's no explanation how any executive could have seen it and said, you know what? People are going to watch this. We should release this. This is well written. This is good content. It's about a couple who moves into their dream house, except it comes with a guest house where Pauly Shore lives. And Pauly Shore is this drug addicted, you know, 60-year-old who looks that way, but is acting like a college guy.
Man, he's haggard.
It's so bad.
He is haggard in some of these production stills. And famed celebrity prognosticator Steve-O is also in this cast.
So Steve-O, I love from Jackass, except he's not acting in Jackass. That's Steve-O. In this movie, he plays a character who thinks he's Jackass and talks like he's Steve-O from Jackass. He's so bad at acting. Listen, I'm no actor, but he's so bad that it actually hurts me to watch. The whole movie hurt. It really did. Now, I enjoyed it. I'd never watched Friday Night Lights, so I'd never heard of the female lead, but that's where she's from. And, you know, she's beautiful. The people are good looking. The men are good looking. The women are good looking. It looks nice. The music is nice. The script is written by people, I imagine, who it's not that they were on drugs.
Is Billy Zane in this movie?
Yes, he is. He plays her father. And he plays this angry father who doesn't approve of his future son-in-law and trying to get his daughter not to marry this guy. And this guy ends up is a partier who gets tamed by the female character, but then all of a sudden gets sucked in by Pauly Shore and becomes a partier again. Of course, it all ends nicely where Pauly Shore ends up being a good guy and they end up friends and they end up helping each other. But all the hijinks that goes on, it's ridiculous. Everyone did that for a paycheck. Pauly Shore is done. And it's too bad because I loved Biodome and I loved some of his other movies. He was funny.
Jury duty.
But it's hard to be that funny when you're 55 versus when you're 20.
What's your favorite Pauly Shore movie, real quick?
It is Biodome because I love Baldwin. Yeah. Right? I just love because of personal things, but I love that movie.
Kylie Minogue is in that movie. A lot of people remember that about Biodome.
Did she play one of the scientists?
Yeah, she was a scientist within the dome. Kylie Minogue.
It's funny because I know her face, but I wouldn't have known her as Kylie Minogue.
Yeah.
Wasn't it Stephen Baldwin in that movie with Pauly Shore?
Yeah, it was Stephen Baldwin.
Am I getting it wrong?
No, Stephen Baldwin.
Have you run out of movies to review?
You have something in your throat, Dan. That's always unsettling when you just chime in and you sound like you have a frog in your throat. Go ahead.
That voice just came in my ear out of nowhere and I didn't know who it was.
Have you run out of movies to review when you're reviewing the Pauly Shore collection?
No, I just watched it. And so I wanted to let your audience know that they can skip that one. I'm not going to just review must-see movies. If I watch a movie and I'm not going to stop watching it, I watch it from credit to credit, and I just want to let them know that, hey, you can avoid guest house. Even if you are mind-altered, it's not funny.
There's always going to be a Chris Kattan or a Billy Zane or a Pauly Shore that needs a check, putting out new crappy movies for David Sampson to review with us here on The Local Hour. Thank you so much. Make sure to check David's podcast out, Nothing Personal with David Sampson. He's doing a lot of good work with CBS Sports HQ. You can find that on CBS All Access, covering the World Series and CBS Sports Network as well. Check with your cable provider. What am I doing, a live read for you now? David Sampson, we'll talk to you next week.
See you later.